Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by John Donahue, author of The Gospel in Peril, Metaphor, Narrative, and Theology in the Synoptic Gospels, and for many years professor of New Testament at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley, California, and the first Raymond E. Brown Distinguished Professor of New Testament Studies at St. Mary's Seminary and University in Baltimore. Father Donahue's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Graff Chair in Catholic Theology, the Collaborative Ministry Office, the Center for Service and Justice, and the Justice and Peace Studies Program. On the 25th anniversary of the U.S. Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter, Economic Justice for All, which offered biblical and theological foundations for a just economy, and challenged our nation to put the good of the larger community and concern for the poor and vulnerable at the center of our economic life, Father Donahue will speak on how these challenges remain vital today. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 8, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Father Dennis Hamm, the holder of the Graff Endowed Chair in Catholic Theology at Creighton University.
Some 28 years ago, that's 28 before the thing was published, the U.S. Catholic bishops initiated an extraordinary conversation on the relationship between the challenges of the U.S. economy and Catholic social teaching. Archbishop Reverend Weakland of Milwaukee was appointed to head a committee of bishops and various other experts to produce a pastoral letter on this subject. The process entailed wide consultation involving many hearings, the creation of several drafts, responses from other public hearings across the country, and finally, in 1986, the publication of Economic Justice for All, a book-sized pastoral letter that prompted robust discussion and wide media coverage. It was an application of ancient principles to current events, expressed in discourse that can still enlighten and challenge us at this moment today. Now, one of the contributing writers on that committee was a young biblical scholar, the Reverend John R. Donahue of the Society of Jesus, our speaker for the evening. He not only had a hand in writing some 30 paragraphs of this work, he has continued to write, speak, and preach on economic justice and the Catholic faith over the subsequent quarter century. A past president of the Catholic Biblical Association, Father Donahue is Raymond E. Brown Distinguished Professor of New Testament Studies, Emeritus, at St. Mary's Seminary and University, Baltimore, and since 2007, Research Professor at Loyola University in Baltimore, Maryland. His books and articles range from scholarly exegesis on the parables of Jesus and the Gospel of Mark to a stream of pastoral applications of biblical traditions to social justice. Currently, his fullest study yet on biblical justice is being reviewed for possible publication. As advertised, his topic is Economic Justice for All at Age 25. Still a challenge for church and society. Please join me in welcoming Father Donahue of the Society of Jesus.
Thanks very much, Dennis. Thank you.
In the United States in 1919, under the leadership of John Ryan, the Organization of the American Bishops, which at that time was called the War Council of the U.S. Bishops, not that they were gathered to make war, they gathered to help people confront the economic and physical damage caused by the First World War. This then morphed into the National Catholic Welfare Council, which is the granddaddy of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops today. But under Ryan's leadership, they issued a document called Program of Social Reconstruction. Even a century later, some of its concerns ring true today. Inefficiency and waste in production and distribution, insufficient revenue for the majority of workers, unnecessarily large incomes for a small majority of privileged capitalists. This is 1919. A major shift in both content and perspective, though, occurred in the Second Vatican Council, especially in its document, The Church in the Modern World. The shift is the way theology was done. The initial paragraph of this document reads, "The joys and hopes, the griefs and the anxieties of men and women of this age, especially those who are poor or in any way afflicted, these are the joys and the hopes, the grief and the anxiety of the followers of Christ." The church is, that it goes on to say, "The church has always had the duty of scrutinizing the signs of the times and interpreting them in the light of the gospel. Thus, in language intelligible to each generation, she can respond to the perennial questions which men and women ask about this present life and the life to come, and about the relationship of the one to the other." The two innovations in this document are, first, it is a document not simply addressed to Roman Catholics, but to people of goodwill throughout the world. And secondly, it calls on the church to read the signs of the times, to derive its theology from the experiences and cultural forces that were at work at that time. Clearly, then, the concern of the council was addressing not only Catholics, but the whole human family. Reading the signs of the times means that it's teaching the church must listen to and learn from the experiences of people most affected by the multiple situations that they are in, both those that foster human dignity and those that assault it in a rapidly changing world. While a survey of the social teaching of the church after Vatican Council would occupy more than one lecture and more than one course, I would like to focus now on a distinctive American contribution. On November 18, 1986, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops issued the document, Economic Justice for All, a pastoral letter on Catholic social teaching and the U.S. economy. The letter, as Dennis mentioned, had been in preparation since 1980, but it drew on the rich resources of Catholic social teaching. Following the categories used in the pastoral message of the U.S. bishops that they issued on the 10th anniversary of the letter, they used the categories of a look back, a look around, and a look ahead, challenges for the future. So now I will reflect on a look back. I would like to say a few words about the origins of the document, the process of drafting the letter, and its principal themes. At its annual meeting in November 1980, in the midst of the Cold War, when Marxism remained a perceived threat, the bishops passed a document described by them themselves as the highest import for the church in our time, the relationship of Christian faith and Marxism. This document criticized the philosophical underpinnings and repressive policies of Marxism. But at this same meeting, Peter Rezaza, a young auxiliary bishop from Hartford, proposed that since the bishops wrote about Marxism, they should also write about capitalism. On the same day, Bishop Frank Murphy, an auxiliary of Baltimore, raised the question of writing a pastoral letter on peace in the nuclear age. Bishop Rezaza just retired after working years in New Haven. Bishop Frank Murphy died in 1989. They were both leaders in the areas of social justice and especially in concern for the rights and dignities of women. The bishops decided to work first on the peace pastoral. That was released 3 years later on May 3, 1983, and it was entitled The Challenge of Peace, God's Promise and Our Response. This document, which was shepherded through the various stages by the late Cardinal Bernardine, remains a landmark statement on Catholic teaching on issues of war and peace. Its major contribution was a rejection of nuclear war, and also it articulated the Catholic principles for the Catholic tradition of what is called the just war. By the criteria listed in the letter for the just war, the Iraq War begun in 2004 was morally unjustified. Only after the challenge of peace did the Bishops' Conference begin and work in earnest on a pastoral letter about capitalism, which now became a pastoral letter about economic justice. The chair of the drafting committee, Archbishop Rembert Weakland, had been abbot primate of the Benedictine Order. In that role, he visited every Benedictine monastery in the world, which gave him a great sense of global problems. The other bishops represented different concerns. Bishop William Wigand, a former pastor in Cali, Colombia, for nearly 10 years, was concerned about the international dimensions of human suffering. Bishop Peter Rezaza worked in the inner city of New Haven, and it had exposed him to the economic forces, especially affecting immigrants. And Bishop George Speltz of the St. Cloud, Minnesota Diocese was concerned about the situation of food, agriculture, and the farmers. Assisting the committee were staff members of the Bishops' Conference, especially Mr. Ron Kretemeyer, who was director of the Office of Domestic Social Development, and he managed, or the secretary, the one who sort of shepherded through the document. Initial members of the drafting committee included lay experts, principally distinguished professors of economics from Harvard and Notre Dame, Donald Warwick and Charles Wilbur, with consultants added later for the theological and biblical foundations of the document, especially Father David Hollenbach, at that time professor of social ethics at the Weston Jesuit School of Theology in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and still teaching vigorously and lecturing constantly at the Boston College School of Theology and Ministry, which was the old Weston, and myself, who was then teaching New Testament at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley. Over the next 3 years, in the drafting of this letter, 16 formal hearings or public consultations lasting from 2 to 4 days were held throughout the United States. Over 100 people representing every aspect of the issue to be addressed offered testimony before the committee. People ranged from Cesar Chavez and people working in the inner city of our land to Nobel Prize-winning economists such as John Kenneth Galbraith, James Tobin, and Milton Friedman. The letter then went through three drafts, and between the drafts of the letters, which were released publicly, the hearings continued to be held. There was a very wide consultation with reactions coming from bishops. After all, it was to be their letter. But most bishops based their remarks on local consultation. They would ask the social justice office of their diocese. They would ask various people in the diocese to react to the letter. From various organizations, religious leaders, both Catholic and Protestant, from the academic community, and from individuals. The reactions there were then distributed to the drafting committee, and people responsible for each section of the letter were to prepare a revised draft in light of the reactions. Archbishop Weakland himself gave over 60 lectures on the drafts and the issues raised in the letter, including a meeting with business leaders on Wall Street. The process used for both the peace and the economics pastoral represented a major shift in the preparation and presentation of church teaching, building on the Second Vatican's understanding, Second Vatican Council's understanding of the church as the people of God and its emphasis on the role of the laity. The committee inaugurated a process of listening to the wisdom of the whole church and to people of goodwill. The broad-based hearings were manifestations of this. The only study, the full study of the document, was a doctoral dissertation done at the Gregorian, or the process of writing the document, by Reverend Gregory Fairbanks. And he comments on this process. He says, the process was inclusive, respectful, ethical, theological, and catechetical. And he described it as an electric time in the nation, the bishops had found a methodology to engage multiple layers of society in meaningful dialogue. I was teaching at Berkeley then. I remember walking through the great mall at the University of California. On the right was the Zellerbach Theater, which had various music groups come, cultural events, and the marquee said, Catholic social teaching in the U.S. economy. There was a dialogue, a conference, a hearing to be held in that auditorium. I think it raised the whole issue of Catholics' interest in social teaching to a level that it had never been before. Writing shortly after the publication of Economic Justice for All, Archbishop Weakland said it described a new model of the church, a new way to be church. And he posed two questions: how the church as a whole will enter into debate in American society on political, social, and economic issues. The key word there is how enter into the debate. Not simply will it continue to issue statements, but how will it become a debate partner? The second point Archbishop Weakland mentioned is how the clergy, especially the bishops, will relate as teachers to a highly educated and intelligent laity. Just writing last year, Kenneth Himes, a professor of ethics at Boston College, describes these questions in different ways. He says, how will the Catholic Church in the United States become a public church? Now, a public church is a technical term now in theological language. It means one that engages the public arena on questions of the common good for all citizens, not simply a church that talks about inner church doctrine or politics. And the second point he said, and this I think is the major contribution, how the church as a whole becomes a community of moral discourse, how you get broad-based people talking about moral issues that affect the common good and the life of our country. These questions remain open questions, vital still today. While the process offered a singular model for the American church, the Vatican viewed it with suspicion and concern. They were afraid the bishops' conference might be seen as an independent teaching authority, which then might undermine the authority of a diocesan bishop in his own diocese. Suppose the bishop disagreed with something. Technically, the bishop is the teacher in the diocese. Would he be bound by what the whole conference said? The bishops' conference itself began to turn away from a dialogic model, so much so that it was described by Thomas Rees, the editor of America, in 1995 as more secretive, more clerical, less vocal. This short-lived practice of letters from bishops' conference as a whole was then ended by a decree of Pope John Paul II in 1998 entitled The Theological and Juridical Nature of the Bishops' Conference, which stated that they had no juridical status to teach and that in order to teach, what they could teach had to be approved unanimously, which of course would never happen with 232 bishops. There's always going to be some vote against it, or by two-thirds vote, but then with subsequent Vatican approval. William Portier, a Catholic historian who teaches at the University of Dayton, stated recently in an article on Commonweal, unfortunately, this meant the end of such conference initiatives as the U.S. bishops, the Challenge of Peace, and the Economic Justice for All. My view is rather than then being members of a church in dialogue, the bishops now, I feel, are becoming bearers of dictates. But now we return to the document itself, which was passed by the Conference of Bishops on November 13th, 1986, with a vote of 225-9 in favor. Throughout the drafting process, committee members stressed, quote, that every perspective of economic life that is human, moral, and Christian must be shaped by three fundamental questions. This is what we should ask about the economy. What does the economy do for people? What does it do to people? And how can people participate in it? Behind this third question is, I think, one of the most significant aspects of the letter. Justice understood as participation, stated in a number of ways, and this is quoting from the document. The dignity of the human person realized in community with others is the criteria against which all aspects of an economic life must be measured. And secondly, both the Christian tradition and reason reveal that human beings achieve self-realization, not in isolation, but in interactions with others. And then it states regarding justice as participation. Basic justice demands the establishment of minimum levels of participation in the life of the human community of all persons. This understanding of justice informs discussion of specific issues, such as poverty and unemployment, where justice demands not only care for people, but empowering people to participate in gaining their own rights and dignity. The bishops were never for simply a giveaway society. They were for a society which would use its resources to empower people, to help people to participate and help people understand their human dignity and to be able, in the case of poverty, to rise out of poverty. When the final text of the letter was passed in November 1986, a pastoral message was appended, which constituted an overture or a summary of the letter by listing six principles which inform the whole letter. Every economic decision and institution must be judged in the light of whether it protects or undermines the dignity of the human person. Human dignity can be realized and protected only in community. All people have a right to participate in the economic life of a society. All members of society have a special obligation to the poor and the vulnerable. Human rights are the minimum conditions for life in a community. Society as a whole, acting through public and private institutions, has the moral responsibility to enhance human dignity and protect human rights. I'm fascinated by how often the understanding of community is affirmed in the letter. Dignity is found in community. Rights are found in community. This is deeply seated in the Catholic imagination. We are a church that thinks communally. We are a church that realizes we are a body, not simply a social body, but the body of Christ. As St. Paul once said, you are part of the body of Christ. You are the body of Christ and individually members of it. And I think that's a difference from the Protestant imagination in America, which thinks individually, the status of the human person before God. And I think this spills over very much into polarization on economic issues, not necessarily between Catholics and Protestants, but those who think of religion as primarily an individual's relation to God, and those who think of religion as a way of existing in community with others. Though the bishops in 1980 said they would like a letter of about 5,000 words, that's about the length of my lecture, the final text of the letter was 60,000 words, which you may think is the length of my lecture. After an initial chapter that describes the signs of the times that warrant a letter, and these are some of the things they mentioned in 1983 to 86, the federal deficit and instant rate, corporate mergers and takeovers, the effects of new technology such as robotics and the information system in the U.S. industry. Keep in mind, the whole cyber world was non-existent at that time. But immigration policy, growing international traffic in drugs, trade imbalance, all these are familiar even now, 25 years later. The bishops state that the long-range challenges facing the nation call for sustained reflection on the values that guide economic choices embodied in economic institution. That's a very important sentence. From the start, the bishops rejected the view that the economy is a morally neutral institution independent of outside scrutiny. The whole letter says our economic relations structures and agencies should be subject to a moral evaluation which is based on the gospel and the tradition of human rights. The third and foundational chapter, the Christian vision of economic life, rooted in the biblical vision of the kingdom of God and discipleship, is also shaped by the rich and complex tradition of Catholic life and thought. In contrast to the previous documents on social justice, this document had an extensive biblical section which aimed not only to attend to biblical passages that speak directly of economic life, but to the Bible's deeper vision of God, of the purpose of creation, the dignity of human life in society. The addition of the biblical section was motivated by a desire to speak to those Christian communities whose belief and practice arose directly from Scripture, that is, our sisters and brothers from the Protestant tradition, and also to encourage preaching and personal reflection that bridges the gap between the Bible and socioeconomic issues. People may not be captured by the necessarily abstract language of moral theology, but they will be challenged by Jesus describing the just at the end of the Gospel of Matthew as those who feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty, welcome the stranger, clothe the naked, care for the sick, or visit the imprisoned. That's the criteria of justice at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. Just a personal reflection, right? At the beginning of the letter, during the early drafting period, many of the bishops did not want a biblical section. They said it's too difficult to write biblical theology in a way it addresses these issues 2,000 to 4,000 years later. I was teaching at Notre Dame that semester, 1983. Archbishop Weakland asked to have lunch with me, and he said, I want a biblical section, and I think maybe you can do it. But I said, why do you want that? He said, well, for this reason, no priest will ever be able to preach on it. They're not going to preach on things like Catholic teaching from the encyclicals. And he said, so he asked me, he said, write up for me like 8 or 9 position papers on issues connected with economic justice, the status of the poor in the Bible, the concern for the marginal, prophetic criticism of the abuse of goods and the abuse of wealth. And he said, don't sign them. So I wrote those, and he presented them to the committee, and then the committee became somewhat open to having a biblical section, which I'm glad they did, because after the letter, Father Walter Burkhardt, who was one of the most well-known American theologians, longtime editor of Theological Studies, he organized a group called Preaching the Just Word, a team of 4 or 5, Dennis has done a number of those, I did a number of those, who went to over 200 dioceses in the country to try to teach local parish priests about how to speak and reflect on issues of social justice. In assessing the pastoral letter in 2003, as I said, though, Kenneth Thimes, who teaches at Boston College, also noted many of the initial negative reactions to the letters. And some conservative Catholics simply said it was warmed over standard New Deal policies. Father Himes says this was due to a neglect of the biblical and foundations of the first section of the letter. That is, they read the recommendations and said, oh, you know, everybody wants to get rid of poverty, have full employment, et cetera, et cetera. They did not realize that the specific recommendations and concerns in the second part of the letter grew out of the biblical and theological foundation. If we want to know where this started, it didn't start in the New Deal. It started when Jesus entered the city synagogue at Nazareth and said, the Lord has appointed me to preach the good news to the poor, freedom to captives. There are two issues in the letter, though, that I feel are as important today as they were when the letter was released. The first two sections, after the biblical and theological foundations, are concerned with employment and poverty. Actually, the situation in the United States between 1983 and 1986 was similar to the current situation, a country confronting recession and a high rate of unemployment. Though history does not repeat itself, as Mark Twain once noted, it does rhyme. Underlying the issues of unemployment and poverty is a more fundamental, more moral consideration. This is where it's not simply a social or economic problem. The dignity of each human person created in the image and likeness of God, to be fired from a job in midlife and to stand in a long line hoping for a means to support a family, or to depend on a soup kitchen to ward off hunger, these are an affront to human dignity. Today, we cannot pick up a paper or listen to the news without learning of the dire situation of unemployment and underemployment in our country, sadly brought home by a headline in the Wall Street Journal on September 3rd, U.S. job growth grinds to a halt. But the adoption of the phrase, option for the poor, evoked considerable opposition, especially from Catholic conservatives. They suggested, oh, you're saying God loves the poor. Doesn't God love everybody, even the very rich like ourselves? Okay. The phrase no way suggests that simply the poor as poor are preferred over other groups, nor the Catholic teaching advocates poverty as a value, except perhaps for people in religious life. Archbishop Weakland used to say that in the Bible, God loves the poor, not poverty. In the pastoral letter, this option is expressed in a fundamental passage. The example of Jesus poses a number of challenges to the contemporary church. It imposes a prophetic mandate to speak for those who have no one to speak for them, to be a defender of the defenseless, who in the biblical terms are the poor. That's what an Old Testament prophet does. He speaks for those who has no one to speak for them. He is a defender of the defenseless. It also demands a compassionate vision that enables the church to see things from the side of the poor and the powerless, to assess lifestyles, policy, and social institution in terms of their impact on the poor. That is, it becomes a criteria when people make decisions. They shouldn't simply say, how is this decision going to benefit a particular group, but have a vision that says, how will this vision or policy or practice, affect the poor? It also summons the church to be an instrument in assisting people to experience the liberating power of God in their own lives, so they may respond to the gospel in freedom and dignity. The option for the poor is not an option, as I said earlier, simply to do things for the poor. It's an option to enable the poor to begin to rise out of poverty and to begin to hope for a life in dignity. A look around. As we commemorate the 25th anniversary of economic justice for all, we can also look at the signs of the times in the United States right now in 2011. First, poverty. The issue of poverty remains paramount. We live in the world's wealthiest nation, yet 13% of the people in the United States live in poverty, which, according to the Census Bureau, is the highest in more than half a century. The National Center for Children in Poverty of Columbia University estimates that 21% of U.S. children, 15 million, live in poverty. The U.S. poverty rate is now third worst among the developed nations tracked by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. At the same time, the economist Timothy Smedling summed up the current trend of rising inequality in an article published in the Social Science Quarterly. Quote, Americans have the highest income inequality among rich nations, which has steadily increased over the past two decades. And yet, the term poor has become a four-letter word in politics. it's not mentioned in polite circles. The New York Times on January 29, 2011, noted that President Obama made history during his State of the Union speech. It was the only second time since Harry S. Truman's State of the Union address in 1948 that such a speech by a Democratic president did not include a single mention of poverty or the plight of the poor. A contrasting sign of hope, however, is a survey by William D'Antonio, the professor of sociology at Catholic University, on the values held by Roman Catholics. And this is very important. He concluded that Roman Catholics, at least in 2005 when he took the survey, 80% of American Catholics believe that concern for the poor is very important to their life as Catholics. This is the same percentage that held that belief in the resurrection of the dead is equally important or more important to their Catholic identity. One of the strongest principles stated by the bishop's letter in 1986 was this: we judge any economic system what it does to people and for people and how people participate in it, as I said before. The economy should serve the people and not the other way around. One of the ways the bishops mentioned to assure participation was its advocacy of the right to form unions, which should work in cooperation with other agents in the economic sphere. Now, quoting the bishop's letter in 1986, the church fully supports the right of workers to form unions or other associations to secure their right to fair wages and working conditions. This is a specific application of the more general right to associate. No one may deny the right to organize without attacking human dignity itself. Therefore, we firmly oppose organized efforts such as those that are regrettably now seen in this country to break existing unions and prevent workers from organizing. 1986. I remember I was teaching a course at Notre Dame in the early 90s on Bible and social justice. And I asked the students in the class to give me an example of a sinful social structure. And they mentioned a number of things. Poverty, they mentioned the pornography industry. Then one student raised his hand and said, I'll tell you what's a sinful social structure, unions. So I said, okay, wait a minute. I want you to pause a minute. I would like you to turn around. And I want you to look at the back wall of the classroom. Just look at that. Don't you see those people back there? And they thought, now I know he's really nuts. I suspected this from the beginning. And I said, don't you see him? I see him. I see your Irish grandfather who worked digging the subways in New York, and the unions helped him. I see the miners who worked 12 hours a day before they could unionize. I saw the meat packers in Chicago. They were your grandparents and great-grandparents, and now you don't see them. The unions, in many ways, helped the American immigrants to rise to their present prosperity. Another area of concern, and perhaps a major one, is concern for the impact of globalization. Though the drafters of Economic Justice for All, at the urging of Pope John Paul, met with the bishops of other countries, and they added a section entitled The Role of the United States in the Global Economy. But it was not adequate for our time. When composing this paper, I had access to a letter written by Archbishop Weakland this year in 2011. He was assessing the demands of a changed world since 1986. And I also then contacted people who were on the original drafting committee and asked what they felt was a major new factor. All responded that globalization should be a top priority. David Hollenbach, who now teaches at Boston College School of Theology and Ministry, also teaches internationally. He's taught in Vietnam. He's taught in Hakima, the Jesuit School of Theology in Nairobi. And he gave an address on June 12, 2010, called Economic Justice and the New Challenges of Globalization. According to foreign policy experts, Hollenbach defines globalization as the increase in networks of interdependence among people at multi-continental distances. This has had both good and bad effects, but also negative effects. Hollenbach states the mixture of positive and negative outcomes led John Paul II to state that globalization a priori is neither good or bad. It will be what people make of it. But what people make of it will be determined by the values that guide their decisions on specific economic choices, policies, and institutions. Yet globalization brings in its train much injustice at home and abroad. Though this issue is very complex, I can find no better treatment than the work of Pietro Rivoli, who teaches in the business school at Georgetown University. Her intriguing work is called The Travels of a T-Shirt in the Global Economy. It's a first-person narrative aimed at explaining issues in the global economy and traces the production of T-shirts in Florida, where she bought a $5 T-shirt, from cotton farms in Texas through manufacturing factories in China, back to the United States for the sale, and ending up as used clothing for clothing vendors in Tanzania, where she says it's the only example of the free market, the unregulated market. It is eminently readable, even for a non-specialist like myself. She told a wonderful story. She began to do her research, and Chinese trade delegation came to Washington, and she talked to one of the leaders about the production of T-shirts, and she said, "Where do you get your cotton?" And he said, "Tesco." And she had no idea where Tesco was. So she had a globe on her desk, and she asked him to spin the globe and show her where Tesco was, and he pointed to Texas. But however, one of her most disturbing discoveries was the power of the textile industry in the United States, and especially cotton producers, to keep the price of cotton at a low level that hobbles the economy of many countries, especially in Africa, that depend on cotton production. And she writes, though the great success in productivity may be due to scientific advances, human entrepreneurship, business leadership, and it is also sustained, and this is incredible, by massive farm subsidies. For the 10-year period ending in 2006, the average U.S. cotton farmer received approximately 30% of his or her income from federal subsidies, though in some years the share was roughly 45%. She then goes on, remarkably, U.S. government subsidies under the cotton program, approximately $27 billion in 2006, exceeds the gross national product of a number of the world's poorest cotton-producing countries. It is also more than the America's U.S. United States aid for international development budget for the continent of Africa. Rivoli notes that both Catholic and Democratic presidents have proposed reducing the subsidies to the cotton farmers. But people today who want to eviscerate other social programs have blocked such reduction of these subsidies. I mean, the people who say that we should be independent, we should not give money to groups, they're giving money to massive, massive people who don't really need it. Okay. There's perhaps a deeper spiritual challenge arising from globalization and highlighted in an address recently by the Superior General of the Jesuits, Adolfo Nicolás, to an international gathering of the presidents of Jesuit colleges and university in Mexico City in April 23, 2010. His address was called Depth, Universality, and Learned Ministry, Challenges to Jesuit Higher Education Today. Father Nicholas warns first against what he says. This is a wonderful phrase, the globalization of superficiality, and how it especially affects young people, where he says, one can have access to so much information so quickly and so painlessly, and publish opinions unthinkingly without the need to think critically or write accurately or come to one's own conclusions. He, in the conclusion of this address, which is too rich to summarize, he then concludes, we need to study the emerging cultural world of our students more deeply, find creative ways of promoting depth of thought and imagination, a depth that is transformative of the person. Father Nicholas feels that the resources for this transformation lie in promoting creative ways to explore the depth of thought and imagination that are distinguishing marks of the Ignatian tradition and Jesuit humanistic education. That is, to educate the whole person. A look to the future. In the last 50 years, Jesuit education and institution have witnessed a major transformation as they gave more attention to issues of social justice. Epitomized in the mission given to the Society of Jesus by its 32nd General Congregation, that is a roughly 10-year gathering of Jesuits elected in Rome that either elected to go to Rome, either to elect a general or to issue talk about issues that are important to the whole Jesuit order. But in 1975, the 32nd General Congregation made the following statement. The service of faith, of which the promotion of justice is an absolute requirement, and Jesuit schools should produce men and women for others. I would like to suggest some specific ways this has happened and will continue. First, Jesuit institutions have been in the forefront of addressing the problems underscored by the bishop's letter, even when they're not quoting the bishop's letter. While recognizing both the integrity of various disciplines, the academic demands and pressures, faculty in many departments show issues in their own disciplines bear on social problems and may even open doors to their solution. Jesuit universities participate in various networks that address issues of social justice. A most helpful resource is Justice in Jesuit Higher Education, sponsored by the Association of Jesuit Colleges and Universities. But it's directed by a wonderful professor at Loyola Marymount, Juniper Ellis, professor of English, which convenes national conferences on justice in Jesuit higher education. The conference's website features an extensive gathering of materials related to justice and Ignatian work at the 28 Jesuit colleges and university. In fact, the next conference will be August 1 to 4, 2012, here at Creighton University. I'm also impressed by the Justice and Peace Studies program, interdisciplinary program here at Creighton. I wish I could take the courses that are being offered. Stephen Porth of St. Joe's University in Philadelphia edits a journal called the Journal of Jesuit Business Education. There exists an International Association of Jesuit Business Schools, which has just concluded its 16th World Forum in Manila. And there are many other things like that. But more importantly, students at Jesuit universities, and not exclusively, participate in a wide spectrum of organizations dedicated to issues of social justice. Emblematic, again, is the Peace and Justice Cooperative here at Creighton, which has as its goal, and I found this on the web, and it really in many ways it's the substance of my whole talk, to align the Jesuit values surrounding social justice and solidarity to the poor, together with our daily actions and consumer choices as individuals and members of this university and of this institution and as a university. I found this a profound and moving statement. Also, very few people realize that in the past decades, the past 10 years, Jesuits have opened more educational institutions worldwide than any 10-year period in our 400-year history. Most of these, however, we don't know about. They are designed to educate young men and women from the most economically disadvantaged segments of various societies. We may have heard of Nativity schools, Cristo Rey schools. Second, universities in the United States should pursue critical reflection on social values and engage in fostering a transformation of values. There is no doubt the present values portrayed in the mainstream media and the goals presented to young people are in serious conflict with the gospel and the ideas of Catholic social teaching. John Coleman, a Jesuit sociologist and specialist in socioethics, recently described 5 major themes that dominate the American cultural ethos: equality, freedom, material abundance, better living through technology, and individualism. There are many ways, very good things, but he says they get filtered through the institutional realities of our democracy, technology, and the free market myth, and partial reality in the legal system based on adversarial notions. To these, I would add one of the values that has to be confronted is an old vice, greed. I just read a book called Greed in the Ancient World. Greed, St. Paul says, is idolatry, because you begin to worship something as a god, and that something is wealth and riches. But recently there was a book published by Jeff Madrick, Age of Greed: The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the present. And the New York Review of Book described this as follows: fascinating and deeply disturbing tale of hypocrisy, corruption, and insatiable greed. But more than that, it is a much more needed reminder of just how we got into the mess we're in, a reminder that is greatly needed when we are still being told that greed is good. Any of you who haven't seen it should watch or watch again the older movie Wall Street, where the kind of culprit who ends up in jail gives this speech called Greed is Good. It is a real parody of ethics. Third, those who educate and who are educated should develop compassionate hearts. And when you marry the students and bring new life and love into the world, practice parenting for compassion. In Jesus' parable, the Good Samaritan, while the priest and Levite merely look on the dying man in the ditch and walk by, the Samaritan is moved with compassion, and he stops and helps. Compassion is the bridge between merely looking at someone and entering their world with concern and help. While teaching at Loyola, I found that experiences provided by the Center for Community Service and Justice are most significant in touching young people who spend time with people who are proverbially down and out. I know personally from talking to Margarita DeBook, a Creighton graduate now at directing service programs at Loyola, that Creighton University has been a real leader in this task. And yesterday I was privileged to meet with people from the Center for CSSJ. Wonderful people. It was really a very inspiring meeting. Finally, and I'm going to shorten this, instead of asking, what can I do, ask, what can we do? And it's very important that if you are concerned about an issue, join a group, either nationally or internationally, that shares concern. Finally, students, your generation is not only the bearers of the future, but you must be people of hope and faith. In all honesty, bishops' letters and church statements do not produce results, though they may motivate and teach. The history of our nation and our church shows that often concerns for issues of peace and justice do not descend from above, but rose up from the lives of people. For example, the Catholic Interracial Council was way ahead of countering racism and discrimination before the bishops ever said a word about it. Catherine DeHuick and the Friendship House, Dorothy Day, the Catholic Worker Movement, the organization Pax Christi USA, which has over 20,000 members. Catholic lay people are leaders in movements dedicated to the consistent ethic of life, to the preservation of the environment, to mention but a few. Now to come back. Pietra Rivoli, in the work I cited above, said her interest in tracing the travels of the T-shirt began after watching with disapproval student protests at Georgetown University against globalization and economic injustice. That made her say, maybe they do have something to say. And then she bought the T-shirt and wanted to find out how this T-shirt traveled through the world. I mean, I think if I asked everybody here to take off the clothes that were made in another country, we would all be arrested for nudity. Okay. But then she, after making this journey, said the following thing. If I learned anything from my travels over most of the past decade, it is that university students represent one of the most powerful forces of change in our society. And that, quote, by 2008, the students and their compatriots around the globe had dramatically changed the way the global apparel industry operates and had completely rewritten the rules for how some of the world's largest companies do business. Finally, very finally. An African Jesuit who just completed his doctoral dissertation on issues of justice and globalization, who is a friend of mine, as he was about to return to his work in Madagascar, I was talking to him about the immensity of the issues that we face. And he quoted to me a proverb from his homeland. An army of well-organized ants can bring down an elephant. A recruiting officer for this army will be available after the lecture. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by John Donahue, author of The Gospel in Peril, Metaphor, Narrative, and Theology in the Synoptic Gospels, and for many years, professor of New Testament at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley, California, and the first Raymond E. Brown Distinguished Professor of New Testament Studies at St. Mary's Seminary and University in Baltimore. Father Donahue's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Graff Chair in Catholic Theology, the Collaborative Ministry Office, the Center for Service and Justice, and the Justice and Peace Studies Program. Father Donahue spoke on the topic, Economic Justice for All, 25 years later. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 8, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.